Her en liten quiz. Du må svare det første du tenker.
Ok.
Hvilken farge det mest av I flagget I Brasil?
Grønt.
Hvilken farge har pengesedler I Donald?
Grønn.
Ja. Hvilken farge har bedriftshelsetjenesten som passer best for mindre bedrifter?
Grønn.
Ja. Grønn jobb bedriftshelsetjenesten som tilpasset mindre bedrifter. Få på plass bedriftshelsetjeneste på grønnjobb.no.
It's Bergkamp. It's up for grabs now.
The next station is Arsenal.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of the Arsenal Station podcast with myself, Magnus Johansson, and my good friends Simen Gauffin and Sivert Skarstein Eriksen. Both Simen and Sivert is absent today, but boy do we have a great replacement. In fact, we have two great replacements, or guests of honor if you like. Regular listeners will notice that I'm speaking English today. That's because our main guest, at best, only will know the Norwegian swear words after having spent a few days in Norway in the early 90s, on a pre-season tour, in fact. Hopefully, we'll be able to dig into that little nugget. For the first time in this podcast history, we have someone with us that actually played football for the Arsenal, an actual ex-Arsenal player. Needless to say, it's a massive, massive honor for us to welcome to the show an FA Cup winner, League Cup winner, and a Cup Winners Cup winner, former Arsenal midfielder Ian Selly. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be on.
We're really excited to have you on, and we can't wait to go down memory lane with you. It's Cup Finals, former teammates, your journey to becoming an Arsenal player, and much, much more. And it's also a great honor to welcome back to the show the famous Norwegian football commentator and massive gunner, I must say, as well, Mr. Dag Solheim.
Thank you.
How are you, Dag?
Thank you. It's good to see you again. Should we talk about the Friday brunch in Dubai?
We started okay. It's just the way we finished was probably not great, but it was a good day out.
It's up to me. You guys could do the show, but the reason we invited Dag, other than the fact that you're a brilliant guest, is that you do know Ian from before. Why don't you guys start telling us how you met?
Well, actually, I was for 5 years I was doing the Dubai International Cup, and that year when I met Ian, I was there with Jimmy Carter, who also played for Arsenal, and we met up with Ian for a Friday brunch. And Friday brunch, Ian, in Dubai, that's something special.
It is. It's a big thing. Everyone looks forward to the Friday brunches. So, you've sort of pretty much got 4 or 5 hours unlimited food and drink, you know, so you can let your hair down a little bit and enjoy it.
Yeah, and we used all the hours, I think.
We did. I think we went over the hours as well, if I'm honest.
But that was when you were working for Arsenal in Dubai and in the Emirates.
It was, yeah. So, we got off the job over there to work as a head coach with the academy guys at with the Sevens Stadium where the training ground was. So, yeah, we had 8 good years over there and really enjoyed it. And, I think as a coach, I thought I was a good coach when I went to Dubai, but actually when I was there, I learned a lot, you know, dealing with different nationalities. We had sort of just over 500 kids a week that were coming through to school. So, we were very, very busy, and just being part of Arsenal in Dubai was fantastic, and we loved it.
You had to drive all out in the desert to the Sevens to teach the kids. What was the standard of the kids like?
It was good. We were open to all ability levels, so we had kids from sort of 5 years old going through to 18. So we had development squads. Technically, a lot of the guys were very, very good. There's a couple of boys that came back and did okay within the academy back at Arsenal. And, it was a mixed bag. But, the league teams that we put into the local leagues all did very, very well. But, I had, I think it was 15 part-time coaches that I was looking after. And obviously I oversaw everything that went on at the academy, the training, everything. So I really enjoyed it. But, the training ground was like a Premiership training ground. The pitches were perfect. I think the fact it was part of Arsenal was a huge pull for us to go there.
But I just like to say about the Friday brunch. I mean, just sitting there with you two guys who've been playing for the club I've followed for my entire life, and listening to the stories from the early 90s, what all the fun you players had beside that you winning trophies. I mean, it was a different era, wasn't it?
It was, and it was a fun time. You know, obviously we took training seriously and took the game seriously, but you know, outside of that, you could let your hair down a little bit, enjoy a few drinks with the players, and you know, George was very good at he was very tough on us at the time, but you know, it was all part of sort of team bonding, having nights out together, and you know, just creating that bond between the team took us a long way. And obviously nowadays, you know, you can't do that. The lads nowadays are athletes, and you know, obviously anyone steps outside of that and gets caught doing something they shouldn't do gets in big trouble. So you know, everyone nowadays has a camera phone.
How did you get away with it? I mean, did you have an agreement with the media or?
No, I think George's thing was that as long as you didn't put the club in a bad position and yourself in a bad position, it wasn't a problem. So, you know, something's got covered up, but you know, ultimately the lads took care of each other. And if there's any trouble, it was, you know, we'd always make sure that it was, you know, smoothed over, and you know, it was all forgotten about. But it was good because we had some big characters in the team then. You know, the Tony Adams, Merce was there, Wrighty. You know, it was a good honest environment. And I always remember when I first turned pro, our trips used to be to Norway pre-season. Yeah. And yeah, I just turned 18 in my first. I wasn't expecting to go on the first pre-season trip and got invited on it. And I thought I'd just be shifting all the kit around and the skips around to help out, but actually, yeah, I was training with the first team, was going out with the first team. You know, we had quite a strict training schedule three times a day, but we'd get the off day off, and we'd be able to go in the local bars and, you know, enjoy ourselves. So we used to have but it opened my eyes a little bit, because obviously I'd looked at all these professional footballers as being athletes, and I wasn't expecting them to go into, you know, drinking loads of beer all night long. And, you know, it gave me a bit of an education how they did it. So, you know, obviously being a young lad, you couldn't turn that sort of stuff down. So we, you know, become part of it.
That was a part.
Did you go to the pre-season tours as well, Doug, back then in Norway? Did you see the players going out?
I didn't see the players going out, but I saw one of the games. But I mean, that was a part of the pre-season thing that in that period. I mean, to be able to have a party to relax. I mean, maybe that did you good as well. I mean,
I think it does, because obviously you have new signings coming into the squad as well. So George would sign players during the summer, so it was their time to mix with the players and get to know them. So, you know, once the season started, the group was very, very tight. And yeah, the training was very hard. It wasn't like we were going through the motions. We'd have three, you know, tough sessions per day. We wasn't out every night, but every sort of third or fourth night we'd allowed to go out for some food and some drinks and stuff. And you know, George was one of these ones that said, look, as long as you're on the bus for 10 o'clock the following morning, you know, it'll be another hard day tomorrow. You know, as long as you're on the bus, I don't have a problem with it, but don't get yourself into trouble. But all the lads were fairly sensible. You know, they enjoyed themselves, but, you know, within the laws, put it that way. But we had a great time. We had a great time over there.
Yeah, I mean, from those, when we are talking about the pre-season trips in Norway, do you have any juicy stories for us? I mean, what the listeners are really looking for, because as Doug said, those days where you could really, as a footballer, as an athlete, actually go out and enjoy yourself and not really thinking about what's going to happen the next 3 or 4 days.
Well, the nights we had out were, I think they were organised by the senior players in the team. So I know there was one night we got invited onto a big boat. And there was all the shellfish on there. It was, you know, with lads. I think George had a meeting somewhere, so George wasn't on the trip. So Stuart Houston took the boys on a coach to the port, and we got on this boat. And the boys were thinking it was just going to be a boring boat trip. But actually, when we got on the boat, there was about, you know, sort of 60, 70 girls on the boat as well. So you know, so the lads obviously cheered up a little bit, you know. Yeah, it was good. You know, there were, you know, lovely people over there, very friendly and stuff. And, you know, I was only 18 at the time, and I was very, very quiet. So I was sort of just trying to understand what the players were doing, and, you know, sort of trying to sort of make my own way and stuff. And, you know, it was, you had to be part of it and be in it. to be part of the team. You couldn't really sort of sit to the back. You had to sort of be in the mix with the boys to be part of the group. So you know, everyone that was new to the group would be straight in the middle and be a big part of what was going on. So yeah, we had some good trips there. But like I say, it was, you know, some of us were getting back at 6-7 o'clock in the morning, couple of hours sleep, and then we're training at 10 o'clock on the ball, getting the bus at 10 o'clock. So you know, you had to make sure you were still okay to yeah. You know, a lot of the lads were obviously being sick in the morning and during the training session, because it was, I remember, it being quite warm there as well. But yeah, it was, you know, it was for me a bit of an education, because I obviously looked up to these guys when I was coming through the academy systems, that they were, you know, these proper professionals. And then actually when we got to the airport, we was in the bar having a few beers with our club suits on, and I just thought, what's happening here? You know, I just didn't quite think it would be like this. But actually, you know, looking back on it, George was very clever in allowing the lads, you know, to sort of go out and do their own thing, but as long as it was within the laws of what he wanted. And it just brought the group closer together.
Yeah. Was that a part of why he had success, the way he treated the players? I mean, he almost turned the club upside down, starting to winning trophies again.
Yeah, I think George went for a certain type of player, character-wise. I think, you know, when he first went in there, you had the Charlie Nicholases there, which he didn't, I don't think he particularly liked, so they went quite quickly. I think he liked players that, you know, were honest players. I think if you look at the team that we had, probably wasn't the greatest team, but we used to work really, really hard for each other. And, you know, with George, he'd always have a game plan on any team we were playing against, especially in Europe. You know, we used to have meetings prior to the games where we get, you know, a pack of the players we're playing against and the strengths, their weaknesses. And it was probably a little bit before that was even happening anywhere in football. You know, it was sort of nowadays the players get lots of information about who they're playing against, but in them days, it was, you know, they didn't really have that, and George was probably one of the first ones to introduce that, and it just gave us an insight to how the other team would play and what their players were about. So it gave us that extra advantage. And yeah, I think with George, he was very organised, and you know, I think the players trusted him and would go through the brick walls for him.
But still, he allowed you to, I mean, to be like a young man. I mean, he allowed you to have the party when it was time for a party, to go for a drink when it was time for a drink. I mean, did you respect him in a special way because that was the way he behaved, or?
Yeah, I think the lads probably did. I think, you know, obviously we were young men and athletes, so when you're on a pre-season camp, it is purely training all the time. So you go back to the hotel, you're stuck in the hotel for a period of time, and you know, it's giving you that release to go out and, you know, say, okay, look, you've done very well so far. You've won this game on the pre-season trip. You've worked hard in training. We're going to give you a night out, and as long as you behaved yourself to a point on the night out and didn't get yourself arrested, and you turned up training the next day and performed in training, then he would allow you another night out further down the road. So the lads would be training sort of twice as hard to make sure that night was going to come again, you know, because they had a good time in the first one. So, you know, George was very, very clever like that. You know, I think part of his man management skills were very, very good, knowing the players that, you know, just giving that little bit, you know, I think got the players to where he needed them to be. You know, I think, you know, for me, he was a fantastic manager. You know, so a young lad going in, I was petrified of him. You know, he was quite firm, George. But when you play well, he'd give you a good pat on the back. And when you play badly, he'd tell you to your face that you played badly, so you knew exactly where you stood with him.
I don't know if you can compare it, but those stories have been told about Brian Clough as well, that he was treating the players in nearly the same way, and the amount of success he has been, it was fantastic. So maybe it's something. How you treat people? But you didn't only do it in the training camps, did you? I mean, you had your day off.
I lived in Surrey. We're still living in Surrey, which is a little bit outside London. So obviously, the lads that were in and around London closer, they, you know, every opportunity they were going out, you know. And you know, obviously I've been quite lucky as a ex-player that my clubs were in and around London. So, you know, when games finished, like with the Arsenal, it was you'd finish your end of game talk with George. Tony Donnelly, the kit man, would come in. He put two crates of beer on the bench in the middle of the changing room. And, you know, it was sort of, I was only 18. It was like, okay, so the lads were opening the cans of beer, getting changed, going into the bath, having a bath with another can of beer, coming back, putting their suits on, going over to the players' lounge where it was a free bar. So within, you know, and probably 45 minutes of finishing a Premier League football match or European game, you probably had three or four pints straight after in the bar, you know. So it was sort of a, you know, the lads would always go together into the bar and meet their families and stuff. And the, probably half the problem was you're in central London. So, you know, if it's a Saturday, it's 6-7 o'clock, you're in central London. It's like, well, yeah, well, you know, that's where we're going to go, you know, and off you go out again. And, you know, but it was just a good environment. I think most, I watch or listen to a lot of podcasts with ex-players, and that era, the social side of it was huge. You know, players were allowed to enjoy themselves. And I think, you know, some managers were letting players have a beer on a Friday night before the game, you know, give them that bit of trust, you know, and yeah, that would never happen in today's game. But back then it was, you know, players were still performing to the best of their ability. So it didn't affect them at all, you know, especially with lads like Tony Adams, who obviously went through part of his career with a drink problem. You wouldn't have known that. You would not have known that, you know, when you see him playing the games, you wouldn't have thought that at all, you know.
It's unbelievable. It's actually unbelievable.
Yeah, well, I've read his book a few times, and it's, you know, sometimes he'd be out for a couple of days on the beer, and you know, he got a game the next day, and he turns up and he's man of the match. It's, you know, how do you do that? You know, but his body's obviously, you know, a lot different to most.
You got a listener's question actually about Tony Adams from Fleskspurven. It's in Norwegian, the pork spur. It's translated to strange nickname, but a really good Arsenal fan who listens to us every week. He wonders how Tony Adams was as a captain, and was he as good as a captain in the dressing room and in training? I mean, we all know about his drinking problem and stuff. Was he a really good leader even through that?
Yeah, he was. And I think he had a, because obviously there was a lot of us at that time, we were coming through the academy system as a YTS, and obviously he was a good few years in front of us, but he'd made it through the academy system as a reserve team player into the first team. And I think the younger lads really respected him for that. He'd come through the system, and for someone that was very, very young that was given the captaincy, you know, I completely understand why George gave it to him, because he was a leader, you know, even at a young age, you know, in the change room, he'd fire players up. Yeah, if you wasn't putting your weight in training or in games, you know, he'd pull you up on that as well. But, you know, when you go onto the pitch with him, he has this aura around him. And as a midfield player, knowing that he is behind me, giving me all the information I need. And if I get kicked, he's in behind me and, you know, grabbing people. And he was always backing the players. And he was, yeah, I think he was a lot better footballer than what people probably thought he was. You know, I think he was, you know, they classed him as donkeys, you know, obviously the Spurs fans did, but actually Tony could play. You know, he was an aggressive player, and he was a very good defender, and you know, obviously he played a lot of games from England as well. So but he was an all-round good guy. If you needed something, he was always there. And obviously a young lad, or the young lads that were coming into that environment, you know, he looked after us, you know. And but also, if we wasn't doing what the manager wanted, he will jump on us as well and be just as tough as George was. So, you know, I think as a young lad, you had that respect for him, that he was doing that for the better of the team. So there was no one that would question Tony. Everyone sort of towed the line and everyone listened, you know. And, you know, he was a good guy and a fantastic captain.
Respect to that the drinking culture again. I mean, what was that a more extreme in Arsenal and other clubs? And was it public knowledge at the time, or has it leaked in the aftermath of it all?
I think most of the bigger teams in that generation were doing it. You know, man, when you look at the, you know, the stuff that comes from Manchester United, Liverpool, it was a culture. When Arsene came in for Arsenal, the whole thing started to change and players were looking after themselves. But, you know, back in them days, it's a tough one, because some players coming into that environment don't necessarily drink as much as what we were drinking at the time. But you sort of have to give a little bit to try and be part of the group. You know, if you didn't join in with it, you'd be frowned upon a little bit. So it was sort of one of those that, you know, you could dip into it and dip out of it, but you had to be seen to be part of the first team group, you know. And if you wasn't part of that first team group, you know, you were frowned upon a little bit. And but I think that was just the era, you know. I remember as a YT player, as a kid, as a 16-year-old, you know, we were cleaning the players' boots, we were doing the change rooms, all the jobs we were doing for the first team players. And I always remember there was a couple of young lads in my age group that were a little bit mouthy to the first team players. And after training one day, we're cleaning the boots, and Tony, and there was about four or five of the first teamers, asked the boy to go and get a pair of boots in the boot room. And of course, the kids got in there, and four or five of the first team players have gone in behind him, and the light's gone off, the door shut, and you hear this, you know. and then the first team boys come out, and the kid sort of comes out wiping his. And it was part of, you know, just respect where you are. You're with Arsenal, and you're, you know, at the time, as an apprentice, your job was to look after the first team bits and pieces, whether it be boots, kit, equipment, everything. And yeah, when you turn pro, you can be quite tough with the younger lads as well. But it's sort of an education that once you get to being a professional, you know, you know where you've come from. You've come from schoolboys to academy into the first team. And anyone that stepped outside of that, if there was a bit leery to first team players or management, they'd be dealt with, and it wasn't tolerated, you know. So, yeah, that would never happen nowadays because people would get in trouble for it, you know, for bullying. Mm. But then it was sort of you had to work within a certain way. If you stepped outside of that, then the players themselves would come on you like a ton of bricks. So, but it was a good education. You know, I think it was the best education, to be honest, the best education. I think nowadays players are a little bit coming through the system, probably a little bit softer, and they get looked after probably too much, whereas we were sort of sometimes left to our own devices a little bit, you know, had to grow up as a 16-year-old.
But you're talking about other clubs, and I had the pleasure of spending some time with Paul Gascoigne.
Right.
and he said, if you don't beat Arsenal on the pitch, we beat them when it comes to drinking. At least I did, he said. No, I mean, that was the way it was. I mean, it was room for it. But who was your mates when you first came into the first team? Who was the players you hang with?
Well, normally the younger guys. So I because I lived outside of London, when I left school at 16, I had to move up and live with a family in Barnet near Southgate in London. Yep. So because I didn't drive, I couldn't make it to the training ground. So I had to go up and I lived with this family for a couple of years. So every 6 weeks I got to come home. So in my area was Paul Dickoff, Scott Marshall. They lived in Diggs around the corner. And obviously I used to get on the bus with them, get the tube to the training ground and to Highbury. So, you know, Kevin Campbell was a guy that looked after me as well as a young kid. Obviously, another one that's gone through the system. Andy Cole was another one that's good to the young players. They all were a good bunch. And the majority of those players, like the Rowcastles, Mickey Thomas, David Hillier, Alan Miller, everyone had come through the same system, you know, and was educated at Arsenal. So, you know, when you got into the first team, that group of young lads were still with you, and they brought you into it and made you feel part of it. You know, obviously, you know, because it's quite daunting sometimes when you have 2 years as a YT, an apprentice, and then you jump into the first team. You know, you've been looking at these guys on the training ground, you know, for 2-3 years whilst you've been an academy player, and going into that environment as a young kid, you know, I was never the next Lionel Messi, but I was a hard-working young lad and I could hold my own at that level. But, you know, it's a tough environment. So the younger pros would look after you. If they thought they could pull you aside and you needed a talking to, you know, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you doing that? You need to be a bit stronger doing this. They would help you, you know, and that gives you a bit of confidence knowing that you've got players on the team that have got your back, you know. And I think, yeah, but that's what Arsenal was all about, you know. Like I say, I don't think we had the best players at that time, but I think we had players that respected each other and would go through anything and do anything for each other. And hence probably why we won the games we did, like the final at Copenhagen. You know, we probably didn't really, no one gave us a cat's hell chance of winning that one. You know, PSG in the semi, people looked at that and thought, you've got no chance. But actually, you know, we put on a good show and performed how George wanted us to, and we got the result.
Speaking about that final against Parma in Copenhagen, you told me when we spoke in Dubai how special it was when George Graham came up to you the day before the match doing something that he never did. What actually happened?
Yeah, well, we travelled over, and the day before the final, we trained on the pitch. So we had, I think, an hour and a half on the pitch, and then Parma trained on the training straight after us. And we got back to the hotel, and I think I think being a young, I was only 18, so being a young lad, I think he thought it was right to just tell me that, you know, listen, tomorrow you're going to start. You know, I want you to do what you've been doing in the first team. And, you know, we had little information packs of players we were playing against, potentially. So we had an idea of what, you know, what was their strengths, what were their weaknesses. And I think the fact that he told me probably allowed me to prepare myself the best I could. You know, I think if he hadn't told me, I still would have prepared myself the right way, but it may have been a bit of a shock to the system when he put the board up and your name's on there. He gave me a chance to sort of let it sink in, you know, mentally, and prepare myself right for it. And I always remember when, you know, the team talk he did was fantastic. You know, he told us that, I think you probably heard this before, he told us that he spoke to the manager about the Palmer players and they were going to get £100,000 each for winning the European Cup, you know. And he was feeding these little bits to the players, and the players were like, hang on a minute, you know, we're only getting £6,000 if we win it, you know. And he was like, how can they get £100,000? So these little mind games he was playing that, you know, you think, hang on a minute, I'm not going to let him get away with getting £100,000 for beating us. We're going to, you know. And, you know, it wasn't our best performance. We scored early, but, you know, we were resolute and, yeah, we got the job done. But just George was very good at that, just implanting little bits and pieces he knew that would fire you up a little bit and give you that extra edge on things. So, yeah, it's a strange one, because I've been quite lucky with all the medals that I've received, or being part of the first team. But at the time, you don't realise the, what's the word I'm looking for, the, how important these medals are, like an FA Cup and a European Cup. When you're 18, 19, it's just like, that's another game of football. Who are we playing today? We're playing Palmer in the final. Okay, right, it's okay then. Yeah. And you don't think about it too much. You don't digest it too much. It's not until you retire and finish, you think, actually, do you know what? That's a huge medal to have. That's a, you know, the FA Cup is a massive medal to have. You know, good players have played their whole careers and not picked up any, you know. So I feel very lucky that I've managed to be part of something there.
How much did you sleep that night? I mean, before the final?
I didn't sleep great, to be honest with you. I didn't sleep that well. You know, it's quite hard, because the European trips, you travel when you're in a hotel and you're sleeping in a different bed, and, you know, it feels strange because you've got another player in the room with you as well, which is a little bit strange when you're trying to get yourself to sleep and they're snoring or you're snoring, or, you know, so it can be a little bit awkward sometimes until you get to know the person you're rooming with. So, you know, before games, I never was a great sleeper, but I'd always enjoy what we call the afternoon beds. So we'd have a little light session the following day, the morning of the game, and then we go back to the hotel, have lunch, and then we'd have a couple of hours in the afternoon to crash out and, you know, get some sleep. So that's the sleep that I enjoyed most, was that part.
But when you travelled to Copenhagen, did you have any thoughts that I could be in the starting lineup? I could be.
I did, because Johnny Jensen just had a knee op. Obviously, Ian Wright was suspended. He got booked for second booking in the semi-final, I think it was. Yeah. So he was David Hillier. I think he was coming back from an injury. So, you know, I know that when the press got hold of the team, there was obviously Paul Davis, Stephen Morrow, and myself in central midfield. And, you know, I've watched the video a few times. It was on ITV in the UK, and I watched the video, and the guys that were commenting about the game didn't give us a chance. They sort of said, we've got such a young midfield in there, there's no chance they can live with the likes, you know, the players we were playing against. You know, the Brolins, the Sprelia, you know.
They have a fantastic team.
Yeah, you know, and a couple of 18, 19, 20-year-olds in the team, you know, they're going to struggle. But, you know, we had our roles and jobs to do within the team. And, you know, like I say, it wasn't pretty football we played, but, you know, Alan Smith scored a great goal, and we just hung on to that, really.
Yeah. How did you sleep the night after the game?
It didn't.
Do you know what? I remember when I watched the video a few times, the last 15 minutes, I'd used up so much energy. You know, I think the excitement of the final and all that went on, I think mentally and physically, I was just so drained. And, you know, obviously when the final finished, it was more just of a relief. And we got in the change room, had a few drinks, and on the coach, we had a few more drinks. And, you know, it was a bit surreal, you know, because I was so young, and we'd already been in the FA Cup final, League Cup final the previous season, and we played the European games. It was all just sort of like a bit of a dream, really. It didn't feel like it was reality. It was just like, I'm doing something I love doing, and we're actually doing quite well at it. You know, we're winning games, important games, and, you know, it was just, it wasn't until, like, say, I retired, I thought, oh my God, that 2-3 years was something pretty special, you know, with a good group of lads that enjoyed a good time as well.
I think we felt it in I was in Copenhagen, of course, and I think we felt it in the stand as well. I mean, all the Arsenal supporters talking about we being the underdogs, the great Palmer side, and we got the injuries, and of course, we didn't have Ian Wright on the pitch. I mean, that was the talking point for everyone. And I think to win the final like that, I mean, it's so sweet. I mean, it's I've been to a lot of finals with Arsenal and seen them winning a lot of trophies, but I think that one was so special.
Yeah, I think
the way even, we did it, with yeah, the team I think we won it with.
Yeah, I think sort of on social media, that's probably the most talked about final. You know that one. There. You know, people talk about it all the time on social media, on Twitter and stuff. And yeah, the support that night was unbelievable. It was it was frightening, and that's another thing that I think helped us. That whole side was just covered in Arsenal fans, and the noise they generated was. Yeah, it was something special that was, and
that was a great night.
You know, it'd be interesting to see how the senior lads like Tony Adams and Alan Smith before the game, whether they started to doubt that. You know, obviously we've got a few young boys in the team, whether we'd struggle a little bit, but be interesting to see what their thoughts were when they saw the team line up and going, oh, you know, we've got Ian Selly and Stevie Morrow in there. How are we going to get this one over the line? But you know, fortunately, we did for us.
What was your dream when you became a first team player? Did you see yourself be a part of a team winning those trophies?
I think initially, obviously my dad was taking his mum and dad were taking to the games and stuff, and he always said from a young age, when I started going to Arsenal as a 11-12 year old, he said, look, you've got to look 2 years in front of you. Who's in front of you? Who do you need to get? You know, when I got into the schoolboy team, you know, Ray Parlour was the year above me, and he was about a year and a half older. He was a lot bigger than I was. And he said, look, that's the guy at the moment you've got to chase, you know. And of course, we come out of the youth team, then went into, schoolboys, went into the youth team. Obviously, Ray was a second year of YT, and I was a first year, and I didn't get much game time in the youth team because obviously Ray was sort of dominating because he was the sort of guy he is and the player he is. And, you know, I was always looking to see who was in front of me. Like Dave Hillier was another one in front. Stevie Morrow was in front of me. Paul Davis, Rocastle was in front of me. So you're sort of just trying to. I was always just trying to watch them on the training pitch and watch them in games and just sort of try and pick up little things from them that can help me out and try and improve me and just sort of see what George liked within those players. So you know, you've always got to be performing at your best every time you train. You've got to try and do the best you can. And I was always open to getting into training early, doing extra bits before training, staying after training. You know, Dennis Bergkamp was one of the best guys that he'd always be in first. He'd always be the last one to leave. You know, and you'd watch him work on different bits and you stay out there and you do a bit with him as well. When he's hitting 50 free kicks into the top corner, when he comes to a Saturday, he just sits in the top corner because he's probably taken 4 million free kicks before that. So it gave the young lads a bit of an education that, you know, he's as good as he is because he does the extra bits. You know, and if anyone wants to improve, they have to be like that, you know, to try and get to where they want to be. So, we were fortunate there. We had some good characters and good players come through.
You played in the under-21 team and for England as well, and I guess lower levels too. How were you perceived? I guess Dag as well can answer this. I mean, how was Ian Selly perceived as a player when he was breaking through the first team?
I think I was just hardworking. I think I could pass a ball. I'd always keep possession.
It's 21 hours,
and I think that's probably why George played me into the European games because I was organised. I always kept the team shape and I kept possession all the time. So, but also I had the legs to get up and down the pitch as well, so I can attack and defend. So, you know, obviously going into the England under 20, 21s and the 18s and 19s and stuff, I was going into a good environment with good players in there, you know, seasoned pros that are there, you know, the Nicky Butts, Chris Bart Williams was at Sheffield Wednesday playing very well. Nicky Barnby was there, Sol Campbell, Jamie Redknapp. You know, we had a very, very good team. So, you know, going to these European tournaments, went to the World Cup in Australia as part of England. You know, you're with these players, young players, and you're sort of learning bits off them as well, you know, that can try and help you. So, I'd loved going away with England, but I know that when we had the FA Cup and the League Cup final, we had to travel to, I think it was Australia for the World Cup, the World Cup in Australia, and the players that were asked to travel, they had to travel. The clubs had to let them go. So I remember all the Premier League clubs kicking up a fuss because a lot of us were playing the first team regular, and of course they had to pull them out the first team to take them to this trip to Australia. Yeah. And I'd played probably the most amount of games up to that point. I'd played one time. Went to Australia. I tweaked my hamstring a little bit, so didn't play too much over there. Then when I came back, we were sort of 2-3 weeks away from the cup finals. And of course, I lost my place for the final because I like to think if I would have stayed, that I could have probably played in those cup finals. You know, sort of one regret. But the club didn't have a choice. They had to let us go. But again, the shirts, it was obviously squad numbers in those. I had the number 4 shirt in the finals, so I know that George would have probably gave me that opportunity, but the fact that I travelled away and come back, I probably wasn't as fit as I could have been, and you know, I got on the bench, but I didn't quite make that.
We were talking about the special final in Copenhagen, but that was a special year as well. I mean, winning both the league and the FA Cup as the first team ever, and you were a part of that. That was a brilliant achievement as well.
Yeah, it was, yeah, because it was obviously the Spurs semi-final at Wembley, and played in that one as well. We beat them 1-0. Tony scored. It was just part of what the George had ingrained in us, that we just keep winning. Like I say, it might only be 1-0, but you know, we probably wasn't pretty to watch. But when you look at the front line, you've got Alan Smith that can score goals, Kev Campbell can score goals, Merce can create and score goals, Ian Wright can score goals from anywhere. So actually we were defensively very, very strong, but on the attacking side of it, we were creative as well, you know. So, looking back, I think as a team, we were a very, very good team, you know. Because I think part of what George pre-season got the players bonded, it helped us over the line, I think.
You were talking about the greatness of Tony Adams as a captain, but how will you describe Dennis Bergkamp as a player? I mean, must have been out of this world.
He's one of he's probably the best player that I've played and trained with. You know, I think, you know, when you see him in the first team games, he is brilliant. When you see him in training every single day, he's better. You know, he's just his first touch is like his brain is slowing everything down, whereas everyone else's brain is 100 mile an hour. His brain is just conditioned to slow things. He can do things with the ball that no one else can do. And but on top of that, he was a fantastic player and a professional. You know, he looked after himself. He was, he wasn't a big drinker at all, but he, you know, he had the respect of the players because of how good he was. You know, he'd always be at the nights out, but you wouldn't see him plastered and falling about everywhere. He'd be, you know, they might have one or two and that'd be him. But a great professional, and like I say, a lot of the young boys there learned a lot off him. You know, the way he trained, the way he played, the way he conducted himself, you know, he was sort of, I'd say, the model pro. You know, he had everything.
I'm obviously a member of the Bergkamp Church. He's my big favorite player, and everybody who listens to this podcast regularly will know that. Arsene Wenger obviously came in the year after, and he is credited with changing the culture at the club, even in English football. But could you say that Dennis Bergkamp kind of kickstarted it the year before coming into the group?
I think he did. I think if you look at that era, there was Dennis came in, Stefan Schwartz was obviously there as well, Anders Limpar, John Jensen was there. There was a lot of international players, European players coming into the team, and their thing wasn't drinking loads of beer. It was, you know, they'd look after their bodies, they'd eat the right foods, they'd have early nights. And you know, when Arsene came in, the whole club changed within a quick space of time. You know, the players' lounge was shut down. It was only soft drinks, teas and coffees. There was no beer straight after the game. We used to go to a place called Sotwell House in the morning before training, where there'd be a gym. You could have a swim. There'd be masseuses there. You know, we go to your peg where your kit is, and there'd be vitamin tablets, you know, 4 or 5 different tablets. There'd be creatine powder, which players were using for extra stamina. The whole thing changed. Even pre-match meals was, you know, dried chicken, dry pasta. There's no sauces on it. Everything was tuned to make you be a better athlete. And, some of Tony included in that, some of the senior players frowned on it a little bit, you know, because it was new to them. We started doing yoga. You know, back in the 90s, yoga was laughed at by a lot of men. You know, it's like, what are you doing? It's not what, you know, you do at that in that time. But you know, look at it now. Everyone's doing yoga. Everyone's doing different exercises. And you know, and to be fair, the players that the back four, Winterburn, Bold, Adams, and Lee, they continued to play for another 10 years under Arsenal because they changed their habits and looked after their bodies. And
How did Arsenal win those guys over? Was it by results on the pitch, or did they win them over in pre-season? Or not pre-season, because it came in 96, obviously, in September, I think. And how did you win them over? How did you
I don't think they really... Anyone really took to him to start with, because he was changing a lot of things. Which, you know, if you're used to drinking beer after a game, and someone says you're not going to do that now, everyone's like, well, why can't we? You know, it took a little bit of time for him to change things. But I think once he got what he wanted across, how he wanted to play, the players he was bringing in, like Vieira came in as well. You know, was very, very good as a young lad. You know, I think the first teamers could see that the club was going in a different way, and to win things, they had to do things differently. And, you know, like I say, with the back four there and David Seaman behind them, they carried on for another 10, 12, 15 years when Arsenal was there. So, you know, it just shows you that, you know, and Ray Parlour's another one that, you know, who'd have thought Ray would adjust to life like Arsenal tries to put across, but he did and played a lot of games under Arsenal. And, you know, obviously the trophy cabinet doesn't lie. They had a great team, and the way they play was how the Premier League was starting to shape up. You know, it wasn't so much direct football, it was playing in between the lines and moving the ball quickly. And I think probably one of the reasons why, you know, I think when I come back from my broken leg, I don't think I was where I was previously, but I think his thing was short passing. He liked players in midfield that short passed, and I like to hit the long diagonal pass across the pitch. And I'm always remembering training when I hit a couple of great balls across the pitch for, I think it was Overmars. I thought, that's a great pass. And he said, no, stop. Ian, when you get it, just pass it, you know, Perez or whoever it is, just someone 10 yards away. And I was like, oh, okay. And of course, your brain's conditioned to get it, and you hit another one. He's like, stop. We're going to shorten it. It's got to be short. It's going, you know, the ball, the warm-ups were always training with the ball. You know, with George, it was always, you know, running, and, you know, that's how we condition ourselves. But the ball was introduced more into training. And Arsenal like to do things at tempo, but very, very short, but sharp. Whereas George would do keep ball for, you know, 45 minutes. And then after 10 minutes, the standard drops because players are getting disinterested in the session. Whereas Arsenal would stop it every 5-6 minutes and then they go again. So every time they trained, it was at a certain level all the time. And that obviously improved in the games that they played as well. So, you know, I think it was needed to be changed. And I think, like I say, I think it was frowned upon a little bit to start with, but then players started to trust Arsenal a little bit, the way they were playing, the way they were getting results. And then everyone bought into the yoga and the vitamin tablets and, you know, the drinks that we were given.
Could you tell us a story about your leg break then? Because you missed a whole season, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a lot of problems. So I had a double fracture. I got it at Leicester. And I played a good run of games there, and it was just an awkward tackle. But I had a cast on it full length for, I think, about 6 months. Was getting x-rayed every 6 weeks, but it wasn't healing. So they decided to put a pin down my tibia, down the centre of the tibia, open my kneecap open and whacked it down. And after 4 or 5 weeks, I had a big tennis ball size lump on my shin, which at the time I was living on my own, so I wasn't feeling great, but I didn't feel brilliant. And the odd occasion I'd be sick during the day. I lost a lot of weight, and I had to start a septicemia. So my dad came around to see me one weekend, and I was crashed on the sofa, not really eating much for a couple of days. Lost a lot of weight. You know, I'd been sick a lot. And he literally just picked me up, put me in the car, took me down the hospital, and I was in the hospital for about 3 or 4 weeks. And they opened up the big lump, the infection on my shin, just left the wound open, and I get it drained every 3 or 4 days just to get the infection out. So they did say if I wasn't a footballer, they might have decided to take the lower limb off.
Wow.
So I was in a bit of a bad way. So, repair myself from that, and then managed to get myself fit. But it did take a long period of time. You know, I went for a few ups and downs. You know, character wise, you know, I sort of went off the rails a little bit a couple of times. You know, probably drinking too much, because you're obviously used to having all this adulation about playing. All of a sudden now you've got, you know, probably 10 months and I'm on crutches and I can't walk properly. I can't even open the door. I can't go and make a cup of coffee. I can't, you know, you sort of go from being completely mobile, doing everything you want, and doing something you love doing to not being able to do anything at all. And I struggled to cope initially with that, you know. But, you know, you find ways of getting yourself out of that. And the best way for me was to go training and go in the gym and do a load of weights, but be part of the group still. So, but yeah, it was quite a tough time, you know, quite a tough time. But, you know, you sort of, when I, that's probably the reason why I've made so many comebacks with a second broken leg and I've snapped my Achilles and I've, you know, had so many injuries, but I've always come back for those injuries. So I know how important and how much I enjoyed playing football. So a lot of players probably would have gone, I've had enough now. You've had 3 or 4 major injuries. That's enough. But I always kept coming back from it because I loved the game.
Yeah. You sometimes think back and think, if not, those injuries had come?
If I'm honest, every day. Yeah. Every day, you wake up in the morning, you think, you know, obviously we've got a nice place. We live in a lovely place at the moment, fortunately, but you always think, well, you know, if I hadn't got injured, you know, I could have gone to there and maybe got to play for England for a little bit and done this and been a big part of what, you know, maybe doing what Ray Parler was doing, you know, because I was always competing with Ray, you know, and, you know, he had a good career under Arsene and done excellent, done very, very well. So there's always that thought that that could have been me or, you know, I could have been part of playing alongside Ray or whatever. But yeah, I'll be honest, every day you think that, every day you wake up and, you know, if you're in the car driving somewhere, you think about football, you think, oh, you know, what might have happened? But it is what it is. You get dealt the hand you get dealt and you've got to move on from it and crack on.
But still, you must be proud, Ian. I mean, have you were fighting to get back and that you were able to come back twice after such big injuries?
Yeah, no, I take pride in that, to be honest with you. Like I say, it was a tough part of my life. You know, when I got fit again, obviously they took the pin out of my shin. Played a few games under Arsene, and then I got sold to Fulham, where Al Fayed, the Harrods owner, had bought the club, and Ray Wilkins and Kevin Keegan were in charge there. So I knew Ray from the under-21s, England under-21s. Mm. Played, I think, 3 games there. Went in for a tackle, and I got a crack probably 2 inches below my previous fracture, and I always remember it was sore, but because I knew that I'd broken it before, I thought if I stay down injured now, I'm going to get that reputation of he's injury prone. But then I tried to get him, try and run it off, but unfortunately I decided to come off. But again, that was probably even harder because obviously I knew the road back to get to where I was to playing professionally again, and then I knew that I'd done something serious. And when I got an x-ray, it was a stress fracture. But again, I had long complications, but it took me 1.5 years to come back from that, you know. So, but I was mortified, really, because obviously I always remember when I saw the x-ray in the changing room, and, you know, my dad was there with me, just burst into tears. I knew the journey it took me to get to where I was, and I thought to myself, I've got to try and do this again now. It's got 1.5 years now of trying to get fit, and it, you know, it was mentally, it sort of, it was tough. But, you know, you get by that, and then within a couple of months, you're back on the road to recovery again.
Yeah, how do you motivate yourself? I mean, when you know it's such a long period and so much hard work.
I think it's just loving the game. I think it's just, I've always, you know, as a kid, loved football. And I think fortunate enough to win some medals and trophies. And there's always that you want to get back. And, you know, when you go to the gym at these clubs, you know, you're looking out the window and the players are training and they're having a laugh and a joke and you're there, you know, on the bike or the, you know, for an hour. And it's like, it mentally, it can, you know, can tip you over the edge sometimes. But there's always that drive to get back. And, you know, obviously, you know, you're not going to be where you were previously. But, you know, I'm quite lucky that I got back to a level and, you know, I went to Wimbledon for a little bit and then went non-league, well, a good sort of non-league career. But, you know, I really enjoy getting back into it, you know. But, you know, I do think a lot of players would have gone, I'm done now, I've had enough of this, you know. But I knew there was, if I could get back fit again, I knew that, you know, I could still get a good number of games behind me and start enjoying football again, which I did do, and I'm glad I did do that.
Mm. Well, you came to Wimbledon in the summer of 2000, wasn't it, when the Norwegian has destroyed the club? the mates are mine, both the manager and his assistants. But
yeah,
what was it like in Wimbledon that summer?
It was okay. Like I sort of left Fulham, and Mickey Thomas was at Wimbledon as well.
Yeah,
so he signed him. We both signed. Actually, to be honest, for me, it was my biggest contract going there. Believe it or not, you know, I was obviously coming back from a second broken leg from Fulham, and I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to get anything near what I was on at Fulham, which wasn't great money, if I'm honest. But my dad I used my agent with Terry Burton, who was there, and I got a good deal. And unfortunately for a number of us, that you know, if I played a first team game, the club was struggling. If I played a first team game, I'd get a good appearance money. If I scored a goal, I got a good goal bonus, and I got my salary. So, you know, the senior lads that were on good money, they weren't really playing. You know, like John Hartson got sold, Marcus Gale got sold, Ben Thatcher went. All the big players there started to be sold off. And yeah, it was a nice club, but you know, I didn't play as much as I wanted to. You know, it was a strange scenario because obviously I was on a good contract. I went out on loan a few times, but I knew if I would have left the club, I would have probably been on a fraction of the money. So it was almost sort of like, you know, I know people say that, you know, you want to be playing, but at the same time, it was like I had a mortgage at the time, I had a, you know, a wife at the time. And, you know, I just decided that because of all the stuff I had going on previously with injuries, I thought, actually, you know what, this time I'm just going to, you know, I trained as hard as I could in training every single day. You know, I turned up when I needed to turn up, but I decided to stay there and just go out on loan a few times, you know, just to get the games in. But it was unfortunate because Wimbledon was a good club. It was a nice club.
Yeah, it's you must have had a great desire for the for the game. I mean, you went to lower divisions and tried to get back. You went to Southend, and you played quite a few games in Southend, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I went there on loan a few times. Yeah, Rob Newman was the manager, so yeah, it was a nice little club. You know, and I went to Woking, which was non-league. We were full time though, so you know, Woking were literally up the road from where I used to live, and you know, I think I played about 140 odd games for them. But it was a great environment. With Glenn Cockrell was the manager there, ex Southampton,
yeah.
And we were full time and. You know, it brought the love back to the game that, you know, obviously I'd been in and out of first teams, but that there was a mainstayer and the level was good. And yeah, we had a good sort of 7-8 years there, which, yeah, and it was literally 5 minutes from my front door. So, you know, but I was just happy to be back, be in a lower level, but back playing regular and, you know, earning a living from the game from doing that and, you know, just doing something I love doing. You know, we used to get good crowds down at Woking as well. And, you know, that was a really enjoyable time in my career, actually, that was there.
What was it like, Ian? I mean, when you've been at the highest level, winning in Europe, winning at Wembley, playing for the Arsenal, and then play for non-league clubs and be a manager in non-league clubs. I mean, it must be a huge, huge difference in attitude. And
it is, yeah. I think you know, I've held a lot of values. Now I'm managing and I've held a lot of values from what I had at Arsenal, you know, how to prepare yourself for games and, you know, you try and give the younger players in your team, you know, information of what they need to, if they, you know, because in the team we've got at the moment, we're, you know, that'll be the sixth league, I think it is, from the Premier League, but there's some young players in there because they're in a good career out of the game. But for some reason, you know, they'll turn up late. They don't show the right attitude, and it's like you're wasting your time. You know, if you don't advocate yourself properly, you're going to go nowhere. You don't want to be sitting at this level for the rest of your career. You need to be looking to, you know. But I think a lot of the players nowadays are driven for money. You know, I think they'll go where the money is. Whereas the generation that I was in, the money wasn't. Money was sort of irrelevant, really. You know, everyone at Arsenal went as a first year pro got £200. That was it. You know, you get your first team appearance, then it doubles to £400. But then you've got a 2 year contract already. They double your money, but then they put another 2 years on your contract. So you've got a 4 year contract on £400, and then you play an X amount of games, and they'll double it again to £800. You know, and then a little signing on fee, but add another year to your contract. So before I knew it, I was on like a 5-6 year contract. On not great money, but you know, they were quite clever. But it was never about the money there. It never even crossed my mind, you know. It was trying to get into the first team and play first team football. That was pretty much it.
Doug referenced your love for the game, and you already mentioned being a coach and a manager, but you also started up an academy. And we have a listener who wanted to know a little bit about that. Magnus Indridason on Twitter, he asked, how did you get the idea to start a pro performance academy, and what's the goal with the academy?
Okay, well, obviously, I run the Arsenal Academy in Dubai, the head coach over there. So when we moved back to the UK, I decided to start my own academy, which is literally, we train at a club called Abbey Ranger. They've got a brand new 3G pitch. It's a nice venue. We decided to target children between 5 and 14 years old, open to all ability levels. And you know, every Friday now, we've got 120 kids that come in, and it's grown and grown and grown. And we've managed to get players to Southampton. We've managed to get players to QPR, Brentford. You know, so the lads that show us potential, we won't just keep them. We'll move them onto the pro club. So the coaches that we have that come in have all played at certain levels, all experienced the game and can mentor the kids as well. So, you know, it's about enjoying training. The sessions are always fun, so the kids enjoy it, but to work on different aspects of their game. So, you know, we're keen to push the children to if they're good enough, they want to pro clubs to start their journeys. So we're sort of we don't conflict with the grassroots football, the club football. We'll just train once a week. It'll be an organised training session. You know, we do Player of the Week, we give out a trophy. Player of the Month, we give out a trophy. We've had Mickey Thomas has come down a few times to you know, speak to the kids and chat to the parents and stuff. So yeah, it's just been nice to be able to give something back locally. You know, obviously I'm back in the area I was always lived in before. Obviously I know everyone around the local town and the area, and obviously most people know me through football. We decided to start up the academy to help kids between 5 and 14 years old, and yeah, it's been really good. The feedback's been good, and it's open to any levels. It doesn't have to be an elite player. It can be a new starter. They'll get put up in a starter group. But it's the essence of just getting them the fundamentals of football and getting to understand the basics. And once they get to a certain age, obviously we increase the intensity and the sessions become harder. But no, the feedback's been really good, and it's just nice to be able to give that back. You know, put that on for them, and you know, I know that when they come in, they enjoy it, and it gives you a good buzz knowing that they've had a good time when they come in. But I'm quite lucky with the coaches. We've got 12 part-time coaches now. So, you know, they're all, you know, qualified coaches that sort of have that same passion that they want the kids to enjoy it and have a good time, but also learn as well. And, you know, we've been lucky enough to send a few of the kids to the pro clubs, which is great.
How does that inspire the other kids to see it's possible? Is that what you learn them, that everything is possible if you...
Yeah, I always say to them, I was never the best footballer in the world. I think I would, you know, I was probably above average, but it's trying to get them to understand that when they come on the training pitch, they got to focus and try and be the best player and do the best they can. And you know, obviously the young ones, 5 and 6, you know, attention span is normally quite small because they're that age bracket. But you know, over a few weeks of them being within the academy, they come on the pitch, they know where to go, they listen to the coaches now, and it's all with a ball, and it's, you know, but it's, I'm always a believer, if you're having fun training, you'll be learning. Because I think I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of coaches over the last 4 or 5 years with Arsenal and outside of Arsenal. You know, it's important the coaches put on good fun sessions that can give the kids an education, so when they're training, they don't realize they're doing certain drills, but they are actually doing it, which is improving them as a player. So you know, someone has to be a professional footballer, so why can't it be them? Someone's got to do it. So you know, it's up to them if they want to dedicate themselves. And you have to tell them as well, the older guys, that you know, it's not all about Ferraris and big houses. It's a lot of work to get to that point. You know, it's a lot of giving up stuff and, you know, extra training and being focused. And, you know, you don't just sign a contract for £100 million a season. You know, it's, there's stuff in behind that to get to that point. So they, you know, some kids watch the players on TV thinking it's easy. They put an Arsenal shirt on, they should be signed for Arsenal, but actually it doesn't work like that. They got to put the effort in.
Mm. Which of your former teammates do you keep in touch with?
Quite a few. Obviously, Jimmy Carter, we still speak to him once a week. David Hillier, I see quite a lot up at Arsenal doing the Arsenal commentary. Perry Groves, Chrissy White.
How is Chrissy?
He's all right. Yeah, he's okay. Yeah. Same old Chris. Yeah. Yeah.
I had some great times with him in Portugal. Oh, he's
yeah, he's a good lad, Chris. Yeah,
he's a good lad. I mean, give him my regards when you see him again. I mean, it's fantastic.
We'll do. Yeah, and I'm quite fortunate because we play for the Arsenal Vets team over in the UK.
Yeah.
So we got our first game in May, just outside of London. So, yeah, we have a WhatsApp group which all the players are on. So we have a bit of banter on there through the week and stuff, a bit of mickey taking.
It's
nice, actually, you know, because it's, you know, obviously when we turn up for these games, like with Jimmy and stuff, Jimmy Carter will always be Jimmy Carter. Yeah. You know, even though we've all got a lot older and we could barely run now, the banter in the change rooms is the same. Jimmy hasn't changed. Everyone's just got older, but are the same, you know, deep down inside. So it's good because sometimes we get overnight stays as well in the hotel before the game. So we can have a catch up, have a few drinks and stuff. And yeah, it's good fun. It's good fun to be part of it.
You know, I've been
about that.
I've been fortunate myself. I mean, to be able to work television with the Premier League for a decade. But how do you find it to be a commentator?
I found it quite hard to start with. Yeah, it took me a little bit of time to get to understand how everything works. And obviously, you know, commentating in the gantry at Emirates now, which I've done quite a lot of games recently, which is great. You know, and you know, trying to get that timing where if a goal incident's happened and it comes up on the screen, you've got to slow yourself down a little bit. And it's just, I'm learning all the time, but it's nice to be still involved with the club and be able to go to Emirates and watch the games, you know, just to sit there in a good seat. And you're commentating, you know, I'm not obviously the league commentator, but I'm just commentating on the highlights bits. But it's just nice to be part of that and be part of the club, you know. It's and it's great to be watching the team because the team's playing fantastically well at the moment. And yeah, a lot of the commentary we do is a lot of positives that we're saying, which is great. You know, it seems to be a whole new different feel to the club at the moment. You know, I did the first game of the season at Emirates and it just seemed different. It just seemed very buzzy and you know, there was no negativity anywhere. It was all positive. And you know, I think Arteta's done a fantastic job there because he had a lot of doubters initially. You know, I was one of them, if I'm honest. But he's managed to get the team together, and you know, he's got a great side there now.
Sometimes it's nice to be wrong.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, exactly.
I was doubting as well. I mean, I thought no, this wouldn't work. He's not experienced enough, but. Thank God I was wrong as well.
Well, I think the Netflix program, I think, you know, he gives you an insight to the change rooms and how he does things. I think the fans have really bought into how passionate he is, and you know, and I think that program's brought them all on board. You know, they got an understanding of what he's like now in the change rooms, what he's like as a person with the players and stuff. And I think that's gave the fans a good education. They've really bought into that, you know, and you know, results don't lie. He's got a young team, but they're producing good results and playing some great football at the moment.
You're a manager and a coach yourself, Ian, and obviously Mikel has done an unbelievable job. From the outside, what's impressed you the most about the job he's done?
I think he's man-managed the players. I think he's given so much confidence. You know, they've got a young squad there, but, you know, I think when you see him with the players, he has a lot of respect from the players, I think. I think, you know, I've learned that man management is probably one of the biggest things. I think, you know, tactics are obviously important, but I think if you can get the best out of an individual, then you're a good player and you're halfway there. I think, you know, I think the way Arteta conducts himself, he's professional. I think it was a big move getting Aubameyang out as well quite early. I think that was a huge move, which I think needed to be done. I think a lot of managers probably wouldn't have done that, but he was strong enough to do that. And I think after that, I think the players respected him and, you know, the players look as though they're really enjoying themselves. When you see them play the football they play, they all seem to be playing with a smile on their face. You know, there seems to be that buzz and that confidence. And, you know, I think defensively we've been much, much better this season. You know, I think the back four has been good. I think Zinchenko's is a great signing. You know, the way he comes inside now, he's an extra midfield player. And, you know, I don't think anyone's ever seen that before, a left back coming inside and assisting players, assisting goals. You know, the way they play, they've got a good rotation all over, you know, and a good understanding, and they're very organised, you know. And that is, I know as a manager, that takes a lot of time to get to that point. You know, it'll take hours and hours of training time to get to that point where the team understands how he wants to go about it. But, you know, he's done it, and he's, like I say, they're playing some good football, some really good football, and it's exciting.
Do you see any parallels with Mikel Arteta and Josh Graham in terms of how he's had a group of young players, hungry players, kind of being underdogs and then just really going for it? Obviously, I don't remember the late 80s, but I read a lot about it.
I think they probably are a little bit similar. I think with Arteta taking Aubameyang out of the equation, I think that took a lot of guts. And, you know, he's strong enough to be able to do that. And George would have done the same. You know, I think as a manager, you really do need to have that respect from the players. If you haven't got that respect, then you're not going to go anywhere. And I think, you know, you have that element of players being a little bit scared of you sometimes, you know, that you can fly off the handle. And I think Arteta, you know, as calm as he can fly off the handle. And when you've pushed him that far and you have that reaction, you know you've upset him. But they're organised now, Arsenal. George's teams are always organised, you know, defensively. And if you look at Arteta, you know, personality-wise, they're probably fairly similar. I think they expect certain things, and if you don't do what is expected, then you're either out the team or you'll get an earful, you know. And I think, he's got that good blend there now. And I think, you know, the players he's got are young players as well, which is great for Arsenal. You know, they've got younger players coming to the team. You know, Saka's been unbelievably good. You know, he's played so many games, but every game he's doing something, you know. And, long may that continue. I think they have been the best team in the Premier season. I think, you know, some of the football they've played has been fantastic.
Do you see any similarities when it comes to the young players in the squad and in the team who's been in Arsenal since they were youngsters? It was a bit the same when you broke through. I mean, it was quite a few players that come through the range of the club.
Yeah, I think they would know the history of the club. I think they know that, you know, with Arsenal, they don't tend to go for lads like Aubameyang, I don't think. You know, they tend to go for lads that are organised individuals that, you know, they want to be part of a team. And I think the young lads that are coming through, the Sakas, the Smith Rowes, you know, I think they've experienced that education as an apprentice, and I think, you know, that will help them when they come into the first team. I think having that history of the club's got, and, you know, the way the club is organised, and like I say, for me personally, what I learned as a kid at Arsenal from 10 to 16 years old, I've carried with me for the rest of my life. You know, it's some of my coaches laugh at me because I'll get there an hour before we're supposed to be there, as in, you know, we say 12 o'clock, I'll be there at 10:30 waiting, getting organised. And, you know, these little things stay with you. You know, don't ever be late. There's no reason to be late. Always leave. Give yourself enough time. Make sure you look the part. Make sure you look presentable. Make sure, you know, on the bench when you're managing, you're behaving in the right manner. All these little things have stuck by me. You know, and that's come from having an Arsenal education. And I'm sure, yeah, we played it's funny actually, in Indonesia, Arsenal legends, and there was we played Liverpool and an Indonesian team a few years back, and the first meeting we had was like an open meeting for the press to see the players and an introduction of what was going to go on. All the Arsenal players were in this meeting 15 minutes before the start time. Liverpool turn up whilst the meeting's going on, you know, they're sort of coming in dribs and drabs, but Arsenal players were all there, you know, 15 minutes before the meet time. And they chuckled to each other because it's like, that's how you're brought up at the club. Yeah, how it's supposed to be. That's how it has to be.
Yes, we have to ask you about the captain as well. I mean, since this is a Norwegian podcast, how do you rate Martin Ødegaard?
I think he's been the best player. I think, I could watch him all day long play football. I think his ability, his eye for a pass, his work rate, again, another guy who's very, very young. I think he's been unbelievably good. I think when he is performing, Arsenal, you know, they're unbeatable. I think, yeah, they never lose. You know, they always score goals, create goals. And again, I think, you know, as a young player, he's got a lot of respect from the other players. You know, he's in the sort of mould of, I think, a little bit like Dennis Bergkamp and what he can do with the ball. You know, his vision, you know, his touch, he can score goals. You know, he works for his teammates. I think he's been superb. You know, and so I could sit there and watch hours of footage of him playing. You know, and again, he looks like he's in the park with his mates doing a bit of tippy-tappy football. You know, he's moving the ball around, but yeah, I think when he's in the team, he's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant.
You referenced Dennis Bergkamp, and obviously he was a very serious player, as you said. And probably the thing that excites me the most is how Mikel Arteta describes Martin Ødegaard, like he's some such a model professional, such a leader, and it seems like he's never late. Never does anything that Yeah, he seems like the most professional guy in the dressing room and the most serious guy as well. And you can see that stare he has sometimes on the pitch. That also reminds me of Dennis Bergkamp. I mean, that depth stare he can give some players. And then there's a pat on the back after the game. I mean, do you recognize any of those characteristics as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think if you look at him as a player, you know, he demands the best from his teammates. You know, I think he's one of those that, you know, you never really see him jumping on players. But like I say, the death stare, the look is enough to sort of say, look, you need to pull your finger out. You know, he's one of them that demands the best, you know, and from individuals. And, you know, but again, at the same time, the fact that I love about him, you'll see him chasing back, making tackles. You'll see, you know, if you look at players like Ozil that came to the club, you know, Ozil loved going forward, but you see him walking back. You know, he had so much ability as well. But yeah. Odegaard's got both. He's happy to do both. He'll track back, he'll defend. But I just like the fact that every time he gets the ball, you're expecting him to do something with it. You're expecting him to open a defence up, expecting him to put someone through. And when you hear him talk, he talks well. He talks like an Arsenal way. You know, he looks professional. He conducts himself well. I think gone are the days now where you get a 6'4" captain who's aggressive. Now you've got a smaller guy that's an unbelievably good footballer. You know, in the 90s, you go for the big lad who was aggressive to get the team going. But now you've got a footballer and the team's a captain that, you know, the players respect because how good he is. You know, he's a great player. And hopefully, you know, he stays clear of injuries and he'll be fit for the remainder of the season and, you know, take us over the line, hopefully.
You said something when you described Dennis Bergkamp earlier, the way Dennis was able to slow things down because he was ahead of everything. Yeah. Is that something you see in Martin as well? That he can do the same things?
I think he can manipulate the ball and, you know, it's just his passing range is great. Short passing is great. Long passing is great. It's very, very quick. And, everything seems very easy for, like Dennis, everything seems very easy for him. When he's got the ball, he's never under any pressure. He can take his time and it's like, you see other players when they get the ball, it's 100 mile an hour and they panic. But when he gets it, he's just on a different, you know, time level to everybody else, you know. And he's a complete ball player, you know. He's not a guy that goes flying into tackles. He stays on the feet most of the time. But he's very, very clever and very effective, you know. And I'm just hoping Arsenal can keep him there for a good number of years because I think he's the centre part for Arsenal. I think he's been their best player so far.
But what everyone wants to know, Ian, is will we win the league?
We will. I think we will. I think we're all, as Arsenal fans, we're all a bit worried that the wheels might come off somewhere along the line. But I think there's enough confidence in the team. I think Arteta's brought enough confidence in the team now. If they, you know, I'm not going to say they're going to win every single game that's going, but I think they're, you know, if they lose a game, they'll bounce back from it. And I think there's going to be some twists and turns. But I think they're doing enough to win the Premier League. I think they've worked hard. I think they believe it as well that they can win it. I think maybe the last few years, you know, everyone wants them to win it. But actually, I think this is the first time when I see them play and doing the commentary, I'm thinking, do you know what, this team's good enough to win the Premier League, you know. And I think they deserve it as well. They play some fantastic football. They've been consistent. You know, the goalkeeper, Ramsdale's done great. Defensively, we've been great. Midfield, Partey in there, been fantastic. You know, Jesus coming in the team, I think, as you know, he's fit again now. But I think when he first came in, added a different dimension to how he went before. The understanding of him with Martinelli and Odegaard and Saka, they all seem to be on the same level quite quickly. It's good to be an Arsenal fan at the moment, definitely.
You've been in quite a few pressured situations yourself, Ian, and I think it's a bit different now. They had 2 weeks out of the bubble, in a way, on international break, and they know now that these are the last 10 games of the season. No breaks, just these 10 games. And, I mean, mentally and emotionally, Mikel Arteta speaking to these guys, these young players, that most of them haven't been in this situation before. I mean, how do you think he will approach that?
I think he'll be quite simple with it. I think he'll just play it down a little bit. I know there's a lot of pressure, but I think as a young player, like I said before, you don't really know the what's the word I'm looking for? For a young player, it's a game of football. You know, even though it might be a World Cup final, it might be a it's a game of football. So I think if you you know, as a senior player, you'd probably think about it more. And if you make a mistake or if you make a bad pass, I think you know that we have to win this game. If we don't win this game, we could go second. I think young players will just treat it as a game of football. I think they'll go out there, and I don't think they'll feel the pressure too much. I think senior players might feel it a little bit because they understand, you know, if things were to go wrong, what could happen. But I think young players, because they're super confident and they're enjoying what they're doing, I don't think the younger players will struggle with it at all. I think I think they'll cope with it well. I think the senior players will be the ones that might need talking to. You know, I think sort of the senior lads in the team that sometimes you can, as a senior player, you can overthink things a little bit. You know, you can, the night before games, you can think, you know, if I do this wrong, if I do that wrong. But I think younger lads, I don't think that'll come into their heads. They'll just treat it as a game of football. Yes, there's a lot at stake, but you know, the way they've been playing and the way they've performed, they should be as confident as anybody. You know, I don't think, you know, there's any way of looking at it. And I think Arteta will, you know, probably just play it down a little bit and just let them go out there and do what they normally do. You know, I don't think he's going to stress them out with overdoing it with the younger players at all. I think they'll just let them carry on and, do exactly what they've been doing previously.
I mean, going out of the Europa League against Sporting and then Man City going through in the Champions League, having Bayern now, two legs against Bayern München, and then possibly facing Real Madrid or Chelsea. When you look at City this season and how they performed, inconsistent in some parts of the season, maybe a little bit better now, do you think City can go on such a run that they're known of? Can they go like 10, 15 games winning on a winning streak? Or do you think Arsenal could afford to lose a game or two along the way?
I think they can. Yeah, I think you know, this time of season, obviously tiredness kicks in as well. You know, the stresses of the season. Plus some boys playing for England as well over December time. I think, you know, it's important that the fitness levels are where they need to be. I think, because sometimes tiredness can creep in. But City are a very, very good team. Everyone knows that. But I think Arsenal just need to focus on what Arsenal need to do. I don't think they should worry about City. I think they just should focus on the games that they're playing. I think we're all a little bit disappointed going out of the European Cup. But, you know, it may be a blessing in disguise, you know. It just conditioning the lads to just focus on the Premier League now. I think having European games can be a good distraction for players that, in and around the first team, that aren't getting too much game time. But then again, when they play, and if you get beat in those European games, it can have a bit of a negative as well. So, you know, I think from now on, the focus is the Premier League. You know, I don't think they'd be worried what City are doing, what all the other teams are doing. They'll just be focused exactly what they'll go game to game, have a plan in place, and as they've been doing all season. I don't think things will change too much.
You have to have a few words about the atmosphere as well, Ian. I mean, how things have changed around the Emirates and the stadium and the club over the last year. You were talking about the atmosphere in Copenhagen back against Parma, but what happened at the Emirates is nearly unbelievable. I mean, the atmosphere is just crazy.
It's electric now. It's you know, I was there the first game of the season, and they just seemed like a different buzz. It was just the positivity was everywhere, you know. There was no negative comments, even if we didn't play so well. There was no negative. It was all that, you know. I think the fans have really bought in this season. And like I say, I do think it's to do with the documentary that came out, that they've got behind the team and they understand the processes now. And I think they bought into it and they believe, you know. And I think when you go to the Emirates now, it's a different stadium. You know, the feel of it, the outside the stadium, the atmosphere is buzzy. You know, when you get in the stadium, it's electric now. You know, and any teams going there to play Arsenal, it's not going to be easy for them. You know, the teams that come there have got a little corner of the stadium, and the rest is, you know, very, very noisy. And you know, like I say, it's good that that's happened, because I think, you know, some years Arsenal fans have been probably a little bit negative on certain things, but it does feel different, you know. It does feel different. And like I say, I've probably been up there 4 or 5 times in the last 3 or 4 months, so you sort of get a good feel of even when the team's not performing, the crowd are still there, the crowd are still behind them, egging them on, you know. I think sometimes in previous years they might have turned a little bit and gone the other way, but now it's not like that, you know.
Who does that affect you as a player? What does it mean to the players on the pitch?
It's hard if you're in an environment where the game isn't going according to plan, you know, and you make a bad pass and you hear the moans and groans, it can as a young player, you can go in your shell a little bit. You know, it's a natural thing to, you know, if you make a couple of bad passes and you hear the groans and the booing, it can affect your game. And you know, some players will hide away from it and not get on the ball. You know, and I don't think that's different to any player really. That feeling of making a mistake, everyone makes mistakes. That, you know, but you know, it doesn't seem like that anymore. If you make a mistake, the crowd are still there. The crowd are still cheering. The crowd are still going the right way. And I think that's giving the players confidence. You know, if they do make a mistake, it's not a biggie anymore. You know, they can just get on with it and move on. But I know back in the early in the 90s, you know, the crowd at Highbury were, you know, they could swing either way there sometimes, you know, if the things weren't going too well. And because George was quite direct in how he played, it might not have been entertaining. You know, you could get a lot of negative comments, but ultimately, they're paying their money to come and watch you play, so they should have an opinion. You know, if you're not working hard enough or not doing the right things, you're going to come in for a bit of stick. That's all part and parcel of football. But you just don't see that Emirates now. You don't see that happen anymore.
No, that's fantastic to be. It must be fantastic to be a part of it. I mean, it's really unbelievable. And if, as I said, I mean, Manchester City got that strong squad. They got all the money in the world. I mean, this must be one of the biggest upsets ever if you take the trophy away from them. I mean, that must be just like Leicester or over again or something like that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, lots of the money they've spent, you know, some of these clubs have spent, it's crazy. You know, Arsenal, yes, they made a couple of big purchases, but normally they don't tend to do that. And, you know, they've always been a club that, you know, don't spend absolute fortunes on players. You know, I think they go for a certain type of player and, you know, it's. I think that must be what's quite pleasing for the club. They've not overspent. They've traded well, and the club, the team they've got at the moment, that's going to be good for another 3 or 4 years. You know, I think this is the start of something. Now, I don't think this is just going to be a one-off. I think hopefully that, you know, they can build on it. If they do get it over the line and win the Premier League this year, which I think they will, you know, it's a start of something big. I think next season they'll be better and ongoing with a few players added to that, the young players getting a bit more older and wiser, and you know, the understanding. I think they, for the next 5-6 years, I'd like to think that they can start dominating that Premier League.
So the future is Arsenal.
I think it always will be.
Yeah, that's a good way to end this section of the pod. I think we share that exact same thought, and I want to go a little bit back to the start of the podcast where we spoke about dressing rooms, a dressing room that maybe Martin Ødegaard wouldn't have been too happy in, based on how he is. But we have an avid listener of the podcast, Stian Berling. He wonders, who was the funniest player in the dressing room back when you were playing, and who was the least funny?
the funniest, the craziest, probably Ian Wright. I think, you know, he was always up to something, always doing something. You know, there's a few stories about him, but we were trying to go from the hotel to the training ground, and we had one of these, an Arsenal coach. It was like a half-size coach, yeah. And it's on a country lane, this hotel, and the kit man was taking his time putting the kit on the back of the bus in all the skips and stuff, and Ian Wright was getting a bit frustrated, so he's jumped into the coach driver's seat whilst the guy's putting the kit on at the back. He's started the coach up down this country lane, and he's gone tearing off down this lane. There was cars. I remember there was cars coming the other way, and it's a sweepy road, and there was a fence down the left hand side of the bus. And he didn't know how to stop the bus. He couldn't find the brake, so he's crunching in the gears. And I remember looking across, and Dave Seaman just put his head down like this. and for about half a mile, we pulled down the whole of this golf course, the whole of this fence for half a mile, ripped all the side of the bus down. He was shaking in the end, but it was funny, but everyone was pretty scared of that one. But that's what he was like. He was just up to mischief all the time, you know. A great character having a team, you know. He's it's what the team needed, with someone like that to sort of, you know, especially when you've got the big games coming up, and someone that can sort of take all the, you know, the stress away from thinking about the game. He can take you down a route that's funny and distract you a little bit. And the fantastic character he was.
How did the managers handle him? I mean, like George Graham, how did he handle Ian Wright?
I think Ian had a lot of respect for George. They had fallen out, you know, after games. They'd be screaming at each other, squaring up to each other, but that's how right it was. But George would always be the winner. He would always have the last word. But he got the best out of Ian Wright, I think, George. I think I think someone, if they went a bit too strict with him and didn't let him get away with certain things, he might have gone the other way. But I think George knew how to, that's what George was good at, how to manage players to get the best out of them. You know, he was, you know, as a manager, he would have been a nightmare. You know what I mean? Just sort of thinking every day you go in, he's going to cause some problem here, some problem. You know, he's just one of them characters, but you have to have one of those characters in the dressing room, you know. Yeah, fantastic guy though.
Do you see George Graham? Do you speak to him?
No, I got offered a ticket, director's box ticket. I think was it last week, and I see George was in the director's box with.
He was on the pitch.
Bob Wilson and stuff. Yeah, I see that. Yeah. I've not seen George for actually probably since I left the club. If I'm honest,
I got a little bit scared because he didn't. If I can say he didn't look well. I mean,
he looks like he's
turned older.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, I don't know how old he is now, but I thought that as well.
Looked a little bit.
Yeah. Is he 78? Yeah,
I think he is. Yeah,
but I see Pat Rice there as well. Pat Rice was there. Bob Wilson. Yeah, all the legends there.
Yeah,
but that's great. The club's still looking after players, you know, and
fantastic,
bringing them back in
because
they're the club legends. You know, they're the guys that have put the club on the map ultimately. You know, back in their day.
Yeah,
you know, and they've been putting so much to the club.
Great stuff. I think we stole enough of your time now, Ian. If Dag doesn't have a few more questions,
I thought it was going to last for 90 minutes.
Yeah, nearly.
Oh, it's brilliant! It's brilliant, Ian. Very nice to talk to you again and to see you again, and it's lovely.
So, thanks for letting me come on. I really appreciate it and enjoyed it.
Yeah. So we take a Friday brunch when we find the time.
I'm still going to have the last one.
Ask Jimmy. Thank you for
great
sharing
stuff,
with
guys.
Us.
Great stuff, both of you. Thank you, Dag, and thank you, Ian. Hopefully, we see each other again shortly, and hopefully, we will win the Premier League.
Fingers crossed.
We will.
Cheers.
Cheers.
All right.
Cool.
Have a nice evening.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Da håper jeg dere koser dere veldig med samtalen med tidligere Arsenal-spiller Ian Selly, og ikke minst Dag Solheim, som dere kjenner fra Kanal Plus-tida, og ikke minst alt han har gjort for norske Arsenal-supportere i mange, mange år. Jeg koste meg i hvert fall veldig, selv om jeg ikke nødvendigvis snakket like mye som jeg pleier å gjøre. Da er det godt å ta en liten debrief her i et par minutter, men det er ikke grunnen selvfølgelig. Grunnen til at jeg adresserer massene nok en gang, det er rett og slett fordi at vi har litt takknemlighet å servere. Denne praten med Ian Selly, den hadde ikke vært mulig uten Svein Skare og Dial Norge, som jo vi har hatt en dialog med for så vidt på sosiale medier og så videre siste halvår i hvert fall. Veldig hyggelig kar Svein, og han som oss så prøver han å produsere Arsenal-content på frivillig basis for norske Arsenal-supportere. Som oss så er han flink til å promotere supporterklubben. Supporterklubben som også har vært med i bildet her med å få. Dere vet jo at vi har et samarbeid med Arsenal Norway, og det var jo de som tok kontakt med oss først, og så har vi hatt dialog da med Svein og Dial Norge. Og i den forbindelse så må jeg gi en shoutout rett og slett til nettsida som han produserer. Der kan du lese både kamprapporter, du kan lese nyheter. Han har et retro-hjørne hvor det er både intervjuer og videoer av diverse kamper som er episke rett og slett i Arsenal-historien. Han har en London-guide for de som ønsker å reise til London, som kanskje ikke har vært så mange ganger i London, eller kanskje ikke har vært der i det hele tatt. Jeg har jo blant annet bidratt med en artikkel der om min erfaring fra London, hvor jeg forteller litt om det året jeg bodde der, og litt om hvilke pubber du bør besøke, og litt sånn. Så har du en spillebørs, du har preview foran kamper, og masse snacks. Så det jo nesten ildsjelbasert, ikke sant? At man bruker av sin fritid utenom jobb, ubetalt, for å skrive og produsere innhold om Arsenal, på den måten som Svein gjør. Fått med seg Trond Sæten også, som tidligere skribent for Arsenal Norway, på, i hvert fall på Gunners.no, så vidt jeg vet. Så gå inn på dialnorge.no. Og få med dere innholdet som produseres der flere ganger i uka. Det anbefales varmt og inderlig. Vi i Arsenal Station er tilbake, vil jeg tro, allerede mandag. Ja, det er vi nok. Nå ble det jo en lite avbrutt på podcastrytmen vår. Vi er jo som regel på plass mandag morgen. Nå fikk vi med oss inn selv på en mandagskveld, sånn at podcasten kom på tirsdag. Jeg tenker at det er greit når vi får med oss en X-spiller. Neste uke så er det, eller uka, denne uka her da, kan du si, så er det jo hjemmekamp mot Leeds klokka 4 på lørdag. Deilig, kom dere ut, bestill dere en pizza og litt snacks, og se Arsenal Leeds på pub, eller sitte hjemme og kose dere. Det er ikke så ofte Arsenal spiller klokka 4 på lørdag, og det er nesten liten happening i seg selv. Jeg skal selv ut, og for første gang siden november, så tenkte jeg skulle slette Snapchat til Instagram og sånn, sånn at jeg er sikker på at ikke det blir noe uheldig content fra min side. Kanskje bør slette Arsenal Station sine sosiale mediekanaler også, så ikke har muligheten til å poste noe der, men uansett, jeg skal ut og kose meg, og det håper jeg det flere skal gjøre, og oppfordrer alle igjen til å følge oss på sosiale medier, etterpå da Arsenal på Twitter. På Facebook er det bare å søke opp Arsenal Station Pod, og like oss, rate oss, del oss på de podcast-plattformene dere bruker. Og så tenker jeg at dere har hørt nok fra meg i dag, selv om ikke har snakket så mye. Så ha en fin uke, og så høres vi igjen etter helgerunden. Up the Arsenal. Ha det, hei.
This train terminates here.
Har du et enkeltpersonforetak eller en liten bedrift? Ikke det? Nei, men da holder vi det enkelt og gir oss her, fordi vi liker enkelt. Fiken, superenkelt regnskap.